Welcome to the 2023 Virtual Region Convention and to our keynote session. And for this session, Brian will be our keynote speaker. He will speak for 30 minutes, and then we'll have a Q&A session for 20 minutes.
Hello. I've been told to keep my microphone to my mouth. So this is Brian V, compulsive eater, anorexic, bulimic, exercise addict, amongst still other things. I thank you for asking me to be a speaker for today's meeting. I'm very humbled to be asked to be a speaker on this level of platform. I identify as a young person. I came in to program when I was 24. I identify with the LGBTQ community. I identify with bisexuality. I identify with he, him, his pronouns. And I thank you so much for allowing me to be of service at this level. When I came into program, you know, Bill W. writes in his story, when he got shipped overseas to fight in one of the wars, and he stumbled upon a tombstone, and it said, "A good soldier is never forgot, whether he dieth by musket or dieth by pot." This was an ominous warning that I failed to heed. And when I entered program, the only thing that I knew was, I really want to run and I can't. And I really want to take laxatives because I can't stand how my body feels. I can't stand gaining weight. I can't stand moving up to a normal body weight, I should say. And I worked for 3 months to gain weight, 6 months, probably a year, I don't even know. Moving from a BMI of 17 to 23. And I just couldn't stand the way my body was feeling. I knew that I had to gain weight and that it was a good thing. But I didn't fix what was happening in my brain. I just accepted a diet and I needed help. And that's the only thing that I knew. I needed help. I didn't know what I needed help in, because I walked into the program. I didn't know what my binge foods were. I didn't know how I was going to eat 3 meals a day. I didn't know about any of the tools, a plan of eating, action plan. I didn't know anything about myself. About my food history. I didn't think any of it was weird. And I had to be in program. I had to be in meetings to hear other people's stories. And I really thank you for this conference convention, because it's so centered on literature. You know, for me, I am dysnomic. And so I'm also neurodiverse. I have some learning disorders that I've struggled with my entire life. And that means that I really struggle with putting words to an idea and thought. The abstract becoming concrete. And it became compounded with this disease, because I used my disease to numb myself out. The lack of food was 100% joy. It made me feel like I was floating. It made me feel like I accomplished something. It made me feel so ultra spiritual. Like I was so good at self-deprivation. Let me tell you how good I was. Because I felt like I needed to be punished. I felt like I was the liability. I felt like everything in my life was wrong because of me. I was affecting everyone else and it was my fault. Keeping secrets and consciously deciding that I wasn't going to blame people. And in order to do that, I had to accept responsibility. And not in the appropriate manner, I had to accept their actions as being my fault. That's not responsibility. That's accountability for something that I wasn't accountable for. And so when I entered program, after all this numbing, after all of this purposeful denial, I didn't know anything. And so I again, really thank you for this journey of recovery. At the time, I identified as being a bulimic. And so when I entered OA, I learned about OA through an inpatient program at my university because I was dying from anorexia. And I couldn't walk the mile that it took to get from my house, the apartment that I was renting, to campus so I could attend school. I had a BMI of 17. And I talked to the counselor and they got me help with a student resource center for individuals who were struggling with addiction. And one of the community leaders was an OA member. And I was like, that's great. Overeaters Anonymous. I heavily judged the name. And it took me 3 years before I would enter the rooms of OA because I thought I was going to do it myself. I went from a BMI of 17 to a BMI of 23, and I was like, I've got this. I'm okay. Until I didn't fix my brain. Like, I didn't go through the steps. I was aware of the steps through another 12-step program. I knew what the steps were, but I just needed a way to live sanely, and it wasn't working for me. So I eventually entered OA. After I called a sponsor in my other program, and I said, I really want to take laxatives. I really want to go on a run, and I can't stand how my body feels. And my sponsor in that other program said, sure, exercise is a great, great thing to do. It'll help you when you get older. And I take fiber every day. It's like drinking sawdust. But if you really want to, then sure. I had to very patiently and lovingly inform my dear friend that when a 23-year-old calls you and asks, is it okay to drink sawdust? Because he can't stand what his body feels. It's not okay. And so I knew that I needed help. I needed specialized help. And what I was doing for myself wasn't working. That just so happened to be the Monday of November, the week before Thanksgiving. I searched online in my local area because I knew about OA, but I was finally at my rock bottom, and I looked at on my website directory, on the directory of my looked at a local directory, and the meeting listings didn't have any meetings specializing on anorexia or bulimia, and I thought, well, There's this one title that's called 100 Pounders. I do have some training with the DSM-5, and I do know that compulsive overeating isn't a thing. Binge eating disorder is a thing. So what if OA doesn't use other types of eating disorder terms, such as anorexia and bulimia? What if they're using 100 Pounders to describe what anorexics and bulimics are? Those who are within 100 pounds of weight, you know, 99 to 199, you know, something around there. And I thought those were the people for me. I was going to enter that meeting. It was going to be great. I showed up and I learned what the definition of a 100 pounder was, which was someone who needs to lose or has lost 100 pounds of weight or more. And at that first meeting, I got something that that was the biggest gift of my life, which was acceptance. There's something to actively judging someone and rejecting them, and them loving you back wholeheartedly, unconditionally. And that's what I got from Overeaters Anonymous. In my local geographic area, there's only two bulimics in that I was aware of. One became my sponsor, and the other one was my sister in sponsorship. My sponsor is amazing. She is the most important person that I needed for recovery. She's a hardcore. She works in another program that deals with codependency, and I need that for my life. And she also has a history of molestation, and I need that. And when I didn't hear, however, in the rooms, take what you want, leave the rest. I knew that from previous experience in 12-step fellowships, but I didn't hear in the rooms that my definition of abstinence, the physical mechanisms by which I work this program, may or may not kill you. It works for me. But the actual things that I do in order to live a life happy, joyous, and free may not be good for you. And in a program of majoritively compulsive overeaters, I picked up a lot of things that I probably shouldn't have picked up, which was very restrictive. People talk about food and food, talked about food. And I had to go into my food history as directed by my sponsor. And I had to look at what was my food history? How am I using my food as comfort? I didn't get the spiritual significance of food. Food is just what I eat, or more rather what I don't eat, the things that I'm scared of. And my sponsor so lovingly walked me through my history and led me through this path in which I had to look at what my food does for me, what my food does for me, because my food is a solution. There's a great line in the doctor's opinion that says alcoholics are restless, irritable, and discontented unless and until the soothing sensation that comes from just a few drinks. I paraphrase the end of that. And I had to realize that food is my solution. I am restless, irritable, and discontented, sober. What I was experiencing when I walked into OA was restless, irritable, and discontentedness while being sober. And I had to figure out how to mechanize and utilize the steps so that I didn't have to carry the shame, and that I could connect with my body in a way that didn't feel like I was betraying it and everyone else. Because this internal script, this dialogue said, you must be thin in order to be accepted. And in order for me to gain the weight that I needed in order to live, I had to betray my mind in a way that felt so disastrous. And so this internal script is what I had to look at, to write down on paper, to inventory, and then turn over to my higher power and turn over to my sponsor, and get some community and accountability with what I was telling myself. Now, that was really hard. I'm going to go into some history with my childhood, because trusting myself, my enlightened self-interest, is something that I just don't do before this program. And living up to other people's expectations is what's the most important. And what was the most disastrous was I thought other people's expectations of me was a societal caricature. You must fit this box. Growing up, I didn't have a lot of, there wasn't a lot of interaction. I have three siblings, two parents. It's a household of six. I'm the youngest. And so I was a lot of, I felt very immature. And interaction with me was really difficult. We had a half court basketball. We had a basketball half court in our backyard. So we'd play basketball. However, if you can see my nails, they're really long. They're longer on this side. And so when I'm dribbling the ball and someone takes the ball away from me, I am in this position and the ball slips, my hand slips, and it goes right into my forearm. And I still have scars from me stabbing myself from my nails. And then I would go into a ball because I'm crying, because I'm bleeding and I'm on the floor, and I would ruin the game. And enough instances of this type of behavior led my family of origin, my siblings, to decide that they didn't want me participating in the games because I would just mess up the game and it would become a crying fit on the floor. As a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, of course, I was a crying fit on the floor because that's what 3- and 4-year-olds do. So it led me to a lot of isolation and I imploded. The only person that was safe was me, and I played with myself. So I disassociated. I created two different versions of myself. I interacted with myself, and that was my community. When I was 3, Child Protection Services was called in my household. My sister got a concussion while hanging out in the garage. She fell headfirst into the cement floor. And she was driven to the hospital, and in her coma, she woke up. And someone from the janitorial staff told her that she asked what was going on because she didn't remember any of it. And someone in the janitorial staff said, "Your father hit you on the head with a baseball bat." She told that to the nurses. It started an investigation that was purposed to find out if my parents were safe. And what I've been told as an adult is the only reason why we weren't taken away was because I had equal affinity with both my mother and my father. My 3-year-old self, apparently to them, trusted. And my family unit was kept secure together. But I was always reliving, my mom would always say, like, be careful what you say at school, be careful who you talk to when you're around strangers, because if you say something, it might lead to another investigation, and I don't know if we will be able to live through it. And so I had to implode. I had to keep everything a secret. And that was really hard because I was really honest and I was really, I could strike up a conversation with anyone. And I needed connection because I wasn't getting it at home. So now I didn't have connection at school. I didn't have connection with my peers. I didn't have connection at home. And I felt so lost. And then an opportunity to have a relationship with my brother became open. And he initiated child sexual abuse with me. It lasted for a year. And I was first day was terror. And that's all that I'm going to say about the first encounter with the scariest person in my world. Walked into my room. The other days, I most likely, more often than not, I asked for it. And I willingly gave up my birthright, which was to have an interaction with my family members and traded it for child sexual assault. And it taught me that it taught me that my feelings would always get me in trouble. My yearning for connection, my needing for involvement was the very thing that left me vulnerable to my older brother taking advantage. And so I shut down all feelings. And so when I entered program, jumping into the previous statement that I said, I didn't have feelings because anorexia was so good at shutting them down, minimalizing, destroying, suppressing, feeling ultra spiritual again. Like it feels like I'm walking on clouds when I miss meals. And the dizziness of the mind is a high end of itself. And the mistrust of oneself, of myself. Lack of food just makes that go away. The internal script just goes away. I just can't think, and life is brilliant. And so the worst cause and effect of child sexual abuse wasn't the start, however. It was how it ended. I asked one day, he said no. That was it. By the way, I was 9, he was 16. And he then graduated from high school. He went to university in a different state, and I didn't see him for another 8-9 years. And this 10-year-old self at the time, who didn't have a brain that was capable of intellectual thought, of actual cause and effect, who thinks that everything is their fault. Children think that what is happening is a direct reflection of them, when it usually isn't. And I needed to know why did my brother leave? And the only thing that I could do was look at my body and say, I am too fat. Spinning into the anorexia of, I will fix what is wrong with myself. It didn't just fix the emotional needs that I was needing. Being distant, being disconnected, being a shell of a self, being not great, not deserving. And the level of protection that if I don't try out for anything, that I'll never get rejection again because I'm in control of what I do. No one will reject me again because I'm in control. I just won't put myself out there. I will be safe. And the other side of that was anorexia fixed that, but it also was a means to find acceptance. The other thing that I'll say that will be very brief was being incested by someone who looks like me, but was past puberty, gave me the experience of a body type that I just didn't have at the time. And I may or may not have ever had. Being an athletic build may or may not be in my cards. Like, I don't gain muscle very easily. And so I needed to anorexia fix that for me. I have 5 minutes left, so I'm going to go talk about the solution. I had to figure out a plan of eating. Walking into this program, I had to figure out what my food history was. I needed to figure out what I did with food, how food was my solution, and I needed to turn that over into a power greater than myself, saying that I no longer make food decisions for myself because I'm really bad at it, and now I have to give up to a power that's outside of myself, which was deathly scary. But I also had to work through step four, which my anorexia totally annihilated. Like anything bad about myself was not acceptable, because I cannot be the problem, but I always felt like the liability. So in there, I could never trust what my brain was telling me, because it always told me that I was the problem. And if I'm always the problem, either I believe it, or I reject everything. And so having an accurate perception of myself was really hard. And so working through step four, where I did the who, person, principle, institution, who was it? Connecting with my feelings of anger, frustration, like I didn't know any of that. I numbed it out of my existence. That wasn't acceptable, because the people that I was the most angry about were the people that I needed to have in my life to exist, which was my family of origin. I couldn't blame my brother for anything that happened because I loved him too much. Or the other individuals that were involved. And so that who was really important, putting a name down on paper and what happened. That was the most traumatizing column of my entire life. And I was so grateful for someone who said, the what happened is 10 words. It's 10 words. It's not an essay. Don't have to relive your past. Don't traumatize yourself again. It's 10 words. How did that affect me? Oh my gosh. I could write my inventory so much on how it affected me, because I could finally accept that I had the right to be affected. Again, it's not 5 words though. You write these like these big overarching things of like my pocketbook, my insecurity, my all these other different words. But it was such a relieving column. The fourth column, which is hidden, was the scariest column of my life, which was the thing that I'd been always running away from. How did I contribute to this? Now, that 9-year-old self didn't contribute to that. My 21-year-old self, my 30-year-old self, now that I'm 30, I have a part. And it is to live in this program in a way that is respectful to me, that honors them. And respect and honor needs to be equal. And if I'm going to choose whether or not I'm going to use one or the other, I'm going to be respectful to myself. And so I had to learn how to frame that fourth column in a way that was safe. You know, that 9-year-old self didn't know what was going on. But my 30-year-old self gets to be the new inner parent, gets to comfort that 9-year-old self that's still bawling inside of me, and gets to be the support system that he always needed. And I get to stand up for myself. I get to say in community about what is going on. And I get to be there for him. That is my part. My part was I was never there. And now I get to be there. That's my part. Step five was walking out of shame and guilt and misery, and being able to look someone in the eye and say, this is my history, this is my story. And that person looking at me back and saying, I've been there too. I love you. Six and seven. I got to have an honest look at what my character defects were and my assets. It's an inventory, pluses and minuses. And 8 and 9, I have got the most fulfilling relationships in my life today, especially with my brother, my dad, and his dad. Those three amends the craziest things of my life. I got to be the best man at my brother's wedding. He got to be the best man at my wedding. My dad he's going through dementia. And I get to understand that I have a father wound. He was never there. And if that's a huge, huge resentment for me, if that's a resentment for me, then my part is today I get to include him into my life. That's my part. I cut him out of my life. So today I give him opportunities to be in my life, and I have boundaries about how far he gets to get, and I get boundaries on time. But if that's a wound in my life, then I have something to play. And my grandfather, I'll close with this story. It was Thanksgiving, probably 2018, 2017 were the years. It was the week after Thanksgiving, so I'd been in program for about 3 or 4 years now, and we were hanging out with my grandfather. He was going through Alzheimer's, and he was so difficult. It was so frustrating. But after that, it was so frustrating. Like the only thing that I wanted to do was leave. The only thing that everyone else wanted to do was leave, because he was ranting, he was tired, and he was difficult. But I got to, anyway, at the end, what all we wanted him to do was go to sleep. If he's asleep, then we can leave without him wanting to leave with us and without him being disruptive and annoying. And so he just walked, he paced the corridor and found different seats. And I purposely sat next to him. And he said, I caught him saying, you know, I just don't want this to end, because when this ends, people leave and I forget who they are. And I don't know when they're coming back. And I got to sit there and take my frustration aside and understand what my grandfather was going through. 2 days later, he collapsed when he got out of bed, and he wouldn't use his walker, which was so frustrating. He was put in hospice and he died 2 days later. And I got to put my feelings aside. I got to be with him for longer than I wanted to. And I got to share a moment with him when I didn't know that that would be the last time that I would see him. And it took me a year to be able to grieve that. 3 months. We didn't have his memorial service until 3 months later. And it took 3 months to figure that out, to be present, to be aware of what was happening, and to actually start to grieve and to cry about it. And I really thank you for this program. Thank this, my higher power, for this program, because without it, like, those moments would not exist. I would have heard it, but it wouldn't have mattered. And I get to be present today. I get to be present. And Brian, I'm anorexic, I'm bulimic, I'm an exercise addict, I'm a compulsive overeater, and I'm so grateful to be on this, to be a part of this convention. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. We will now open the floor for a question and answer session. So a question would, you know, being a member of several focus groups and your first meeting being 100-pounder and you felt acceptance, how long was it before your second meeting, and what did you see, hear, relate that kept you coming back?
By that time, I was already a service junkie, I guess I could say. I went to a meeting every day in another fellowship, and I wasn't working at the time. I couldn't work at the time. I was recovering from anorexia. Like, my body just, I slept probably 12, 18 hours a day. And that's what I needed in order to recover, because my body was was dying. And so the only thing that I did was sleep. I ate food and I went to a meeting. So that Sunday was a meeting, OA meeting. That Monday was an OA meeting. Tuesday, I went to another meeting for another fellowship that dealt with anorexia and bulimia. Took 2 hours to drive there. And the, yeah. So I knew that the steps worked because of my other fellowship. And I knew that I knew the steps worked, and I was here for the ride. It didn't take me, I didn't learn. Yeah, I guess I'll just stop it there.
Thank you. Another question. How do you blend your concept of a higher power with your inner parent?
That's really difficult. For a long time, my higher power was like, I would get visions of my higher power. My relationship, I had to learn how to trust my higher power, like physically and emotionally. And my inner parent, I also had to learn how to trust, because my inner child had every right to be frustrated and rageful, because I wasn't taking care of it, him. I wasn't taking care of myself. I wasn't feeding myself 3 times a day. I was only eating 1,500 calories a day. Like, I wasn't taking care of myself. And I was so codependent that I was doing everything for everyone else. My inner child did not trust me. It couldn't trust me physically. It couldn't trust me emotionally. It couldn't trust me spiritually. Like, it did not trust me. And so I had to work and develop a relationship and say hi to my inner child, like every day, like in meditation, like have these like conversations. And I had to validate him, and I had to be there for him when he didn't even want to talk to me. And so now relationship with my higher power is very similar. I wanted a physical relationship with my higher power, and I couldn't get that because it's nebulous. And I broke down in frustration and was like, God, where are you? And I had this like still small voice in my head that said, I am joy. If you want to find my touch is joy. Whenever you feel joy, that is me. And I will always be there. Thank you.
Bye. So we have another one. That's interesting. First of all, thank you for your vulnerability. Why would you make an amend to your brother?
That's a good question. When I was getting married, you know, when I was his best man, like I wasn't in program yet. This was 2014. And we drove from California to Washington. And I felt like I was being placed in a cage to be delivered to my abuser. And I got the luxury of having 18 hours to figure that out. Like 2 days. It was a 2-day drive. You know, the similar with my father, I had to realize that I had a wound. If what I want is to have my brother in my life, cutting him out of my life doesn't serve me, right? But I also had to find out whether or not he was safe. And in that time, I spent a week with him before his wedding, with him around around my family. And I got to observe him because I hadn't talked to him since the end of the abuse. Like, this was from 2000, whatever the years were. It was like 10 years later. So I had to figure out who he was. And I got enough signs to find out that he was a trustful person. Like, I don't talk to him every day. Like, he's not integral into my life. He's still in another state. But we have a mutual agreement, I guess. The other thing was when I was working on my marriage, planning for my marriage. I decided that I was going to have my brother is my best man. And my pastor was like, I don't know if I can marry you next to him. My wife was like, I don't know if I want him in the room. And I was like, what's the name of your church? Restoration. Like, it's true. I could cut him out of my life. But where is that energy coming from? Is that revenge? Or is it safety? If it's safety, it's warranted. If it's revenge, I have a part. And my inventory needs to be taken. And if the only reason why I'm cutting him out of my life is to show him revenge, I cannot healthfully make that decision to be the judge executioner for something he did when he was 14. Like, yes, he was more of an adult than I was, but does he need the sentence for the rest of his life?
Thank you. All right. So this is kind of a two-part question, but I'll ask the first part. So in what ways has the cultivation of self-compassion and adopting a nurturing approach towards oneself altered the trajectory of your recovery journey as compared to the rigid and punitive tough love approach?
Thank you. In my other program, it took me a year to do step one. And in that other program, it was write out every single slip and whatever. You had to write down your inventory. And I didn't know my past. Like, I threw it out. Like, and so if I was going to do that, like, I had to look at my past. And I, one, I didn't remember it. Two, I didn't want to remember it. And three, it was terrifying. So that took time. In order to walk down that line, I learned through experience. Unfortunately, I wasn't told this, but I learned through experience to have grace in my second column. Because I wrote books. I wrote books and I re-traumatized myself. If I am ever going to look at my past, it needs to be through a lens of compassion. Because I believe that food and everything else that I've tried to numb my emotions is a solution. And if I'm going to live happy, joyous, and free, I need to live in a life that that enables me to be happy, joyous, and free without picking up my addictive behaviors. Because I am happy, joyous, and free while I'm in anorexia. I am. It just so happens that my misery, discontentedness, and self-sabotage pushes through that. And it no longer helps to medicate. It becomes so strong that it no longer helps to medicate. And so now I need another solution because obviously what I've been doing isn't working. And I need something that is my maladaptive defensive mechanisms, my imploding, my collapsing, my shutting the world out because it becomes too scary, and disassociating and disconnecting. That is my escape mechanism. And I do a lot of things in order to do it. Lots of methods are useful. However, they have consequences of their own. But my restlessness, my irritability, my discontentedness is not caused by my food or my food behaviors. It is me, unmedicated. And if I'm going to be medicated, I need to be working the steps to work through what my complicated emotions, to work through bringing them to light to another person, getting outside perspective. And if I'm going to be doing that, the clutcher was compassion. If I'm going to be doing that, looking at my past, I need to have the lens of compassion because that child did everything he could to survive. And he picked up tools that he knew at the time and he survived it. I'm so grateful for that. Today, I can have different responses. But if I'm going to be the critical inner parent and punish my inner child for what he did to keep me alive, it's not okay. And thank you for that question. It's a good one.
The second part of from the same member said, how do you integrate psychological self-awareness into the 12-step spiritual solution? Have you ever experienced a conflict between the two, or perhaps an overemphasis on intellectualizing the process of transformation?
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes. I realize there's so little time left. I'm going to read a quote from the 12-Step Within Handbook. There. It says, we all know how to identify dysfunction. So it isn't so much an issue of not knowing there is a problem as it is doing something about it. Being long on wisdom, do we opt for serenity or courage? Do we accept it or change it? Intervene or avoidance? If not you, then who? And to answer that question, there's a lot as a newcomer, there was a lot of stuff that didn't sit right with me in the 12 steps. One was my part, two was the serenity prayer. Because I'm ultra spiritual, I can neglect my feelings and opt for serenity when I should be using courage. And I can now go to the space of wisdom, do something in courage, and let my higher power figure out the serenity. Serenely accept the outcome of whatever I did to have courage. And that quote that I'm so lovely, so glad that is in our literature, is my problem with the Serenity Prayer, which is being long on wisdom. Do I opt for serenity? Where is my courage? And if I am not my biggest, if I am not in my circle, no one else will be. And that's not even true. This program is in my circle. And I had to be in the position of being loved and accepted until I could love myself. And that's what that 100-pounder meeting did for me. 100%. And that's what these meetings do for me. Thank you.
Speaking to neurodivergency, how do you find yourself adapting program to meet your needs as your mind need? How do you navigate the black and white concepts?
I think there's a tremendous amount of humility and courage that the big book authors write whenever they use the word suggested. These are the steps and are suggested as a program of recovery. You know, we don't have a monopoly on the higher power. seek outside help. We do not minimize or discredit or discourage individuals looking for help. 12-step programs are the most phenomenal thing in the world because they're so flexible. And with neurodivergence, I'm just graphic, I'm dyslexic, and I'm dysnomic. And so I don't handle language well, specifically doing two things at once with language. I think it is also coming back to compassion, coming back to my strengths and weaknesses, being mindful of my inventory on how my weaknesses are there, but I do have tremendous strengths. And it's also with the program. I can't put into words what it means to be elected to a position that I cannot do, that I feel like I am incapable of, and having the program surround me to be able to support me to do it. With them physically saying, we will be here for you when you fail. You can express courage here, and you don't have to be scared of it, because that was my fear of success. And keeping myself into a box, keeping myself small, keeping myself non-existent and disappeared was not healthy. And walking into service and allowing individuals to help me, being open to ask questions about where I need help, and working on my character defects and working on my ability to say I'm sorry and working on, you know, all of those things. The program was there to catch me when I fell and to praise me when I did something right, even when I don't think I still did.
Right. I'm going to take just one more minute because someone has asked, in regard to your brother, did you actually say the formal amen? Example, I hurt you in this way, etc.
I didn't. In honesty, we have not had that conversation. We have not addressed it. And I don't need that for my recovery journey. I'm not here waiting for an apology. I've heard siblings share with me that he was bawling for some reason that they didn't understand. I don't need things from him. It's not a prerequisite for recovery. To get my amends. That conversation will come. It will happen. And I am here for the journey.